We are talking these weeks about a subject called uncommon, and we're working our way through the Bible and speaking about different characters in the Bible that sometimes we miss when we do full book studies. And today we're going to be with Elisha, not Elijah. There's Elijah the prophet and Elisha the prophet, and we're going to look at mercy. And mercy is an amazing concept. We're going to be in 2 Kings chapter 6. But mercy is not the first thing you think about when you think of the Old Testament. You think of judgment, you think of wars, you think of killing, you think of all these incredible things. But mercy really shines through, and we're going to see it in 2 Kings chapter 6. If you don't have a Bible, take the one in front of you. If you don't own a Bible, keep the one in front of you. Those Bibles are for you. If you own a Bible and didn't bring it, use that one, put it back. But if you don't have a Bible, the Bible is for you. We love giving away Bibles, so just take it with you. We're in 2 Kings chapter 6. And as we introduce this, I just want to share a story of something that happened to me a couple years ago, the last year before I became a pastor, about the time that John and Yannick, we were praying with them. I wasn't a pastor, a senior pastor here. I just was part-time pastor, but I also ran a real estate company or a division of a real estate company, and I was in the real estate business for many, many years. And so every year, the parent company required us to do business plans. And many of you have done strategic business plans for your business. So it was in October, early November, every year for the 5 years I worked for this company, we had to do a plan. And in that plan, there was about 45 pages of information I gave in that plan. Well, who reads 45 pages? So you do an executive summary and put it on the front page of your plan, which gives all the numbers, because that's what they really care about. Are you going to reach the numbers that everybody thinks you're supposed to? So in the years I reached the numbers, they were happy. In the years I exceeded the numbers, they gave me a bonus. And the years I didn't exceed it and didn't make it, they would say, why didn't you make it? Pretty typical. But I was feeling guilty about this whole process because I had a personal plan as well. And in the personal plan, I had my view of character in business, my view of integrity in business, my view of diligence in business, my view of my own personal work ethic in business. And I had that all written out. They never asked me about any of that. It was kind of the Christian side of what I did, and they never asked me for that. And every year I thought, why am I not telling them this? Because this infuses the 45 pages. And I never did it. So the last year, I didn't know it was the last year I was going to be doing this, but the last year I did it. And I thought, I'll just put it at the end as an addendum on the 46th page for about 4 or 5 pages. I thought, they'll never see it, but at least I'll feel good about it. And so I did that, and I sent it off to corporate headquarters in Sarasota, and off it went. It was two weeks before Thanksgiving. The week of Thanksgiving, I get a call from my boss, the president of the division, his assistant. She was a high-end assistant, been 30 years with the company, a brilliant woman who kind of ran it for him. He was the figurehead, but she was the brains behind it. And she calls me up, and she goes, Bill, thank you for your business plan. So I just thought, it's Thanksgiving week. She's making an obligatory call that I received it. Happy Thanksgiving. And then she broke down and began to cry. Now, this is a lady that was a very strong businesswoman for years, probably in her mid-50s at the time, just an incredible lady. She's crying on the phone to me. I go, what's up? She goes, I read the last 4 pages. Now, just to step back a minute, I never knew or thought there were any Christians in the corporate part of our business. It's a very pagan company, very, you know, chop-chop. No Christians in the corporate side of this company. I've been over there many times, never met a Christian. And I talked to her many times, nice lady, but no Christians there. She came to me crying on the phone, and she said, Bill, I'm a Christian, and I've never told a soul in this business. I said, how long have you been working there? She said, like 20 years. I said, you've never told anybody? And she said, I was wrong. And she said, thank you. We said, happy Thanksgiving, etc. And she hung up. The very next day, which I think was Wednesday before Thanksgiving, I get a call from the president of the entire company. So I know this business plan is moving down the hallway. And the assistant to the president of the company calls me. Again, a great lady, strong businesswoman, runs the company. I mean, just an incredible, brilliant woman. And she thanks me, and she starts crying. And I go, wow, what's going on? Literally, 24 hours later, she's crying on the phone to me. And she goes, Bill, I'm a Christian, and I've never told anybody in this business that I'm a Christian. It was the same exact, almost words, not exactly, but the same thought. And I asked her, how long have you been in this business? 10 or 15 years, whatever it was. And I said, you've never told a soul? She said, no. She said, but I will now. Later that afternoon, the president of the company called me up, and this is very, very true. I don't tell stories that aren't true. He called me up and he said, stop making my staff cry. Later on, 6 months later, I called him up and said, I'm going into ministry. And he said, I knew it the day we talked, the day before Thanksgiving 6 months ago, when my two assistants came to me and started talking to me about God. And I said, where did you hear that from? And they said, Bill Mitchell from Boca Raton. But here's the point. We are embedded in many places, and people don't even know that we're a Christian. And yet we're embedded in these places. And our call today as we open the scriptures is act like a Christian and talk like a Christian and be a Christian wherever you are placed. It does not matter where you are placed. And I'm not talking about right here. Of course, we're going to talk about Christian things today, and of course, in a Bible study you do, but out there, because there's an incredible need to show mercy and grace that we just sung about that God has given us. Well, let's look at it in 2 Kings chapter 6. There are three great stories in these verses in 2 Kings 6, starting in verse 1, and I'll share you the first story. I won't read it because it'll take too long to read the whole chapter, so let me give you the first story, verses 1 to 7. Elisha has just taken over the last few years, the mantle from his mentor who was Elijah. Elijah's the guy who called down fire from heaven. Elijah's the guy who went up. We heard, if you read a few chapters before, went up with chariots of fire. He's one of the few men who never has died. Enoch, I believe, in Genesis, and Elijah are probably the only two people who have never died. I've never died either, but I will someday, but they never died. I mean, it's amazing. So that's his mentor, and the thing that he asked for, Elisha asked from Elijah, at the end of the day, he said to Elijah, would you pray? And Elijah said, what do you want? And he didn't want money. He didn't even want wisdom, which Solomon prayed for. He said, I want a double blessing from God. Whatever that means, I want God to bless me. Elisha never got money. He never got houses. He got fame, but not the kind of fame we think about. He got blessed by God. So here's Elisha. He has a group of prophets around him. They're very poor. So he's getting blessed by God and still being poor. And they're living in a place, they were so poor, the other guys, his underlings, the guys that he's training go, Elisha, they called him father most of the times, or master. They said, it's so poor here. Can we go down by the river and cut some wood and make new houses? Houses back then, what he means was lean-tos. They'd make a three-sided hut, and then they'd live in it almost like a precursor to a modern tent. And so they'd make a hut, and then you'd make a hut, and you'd make and kind of live by the river where the breezes were and the fig trees. And so he goes, yeah, let's go do it. And so they went down there, and one of them had an axe. Now, you and I having axes is no big deal, but back then, iron, which was the head of the axe, was something that was brand new, expensive. So it would be equivalent for me to come to you and say, can I borrow your car? And you hand me the keys. with the hope that I bring the keys back to you the next day, right? So he has this axe because it's a lot easier than felling it the old way. So they're axing and they're doing all this work and it breaks. And the axe head, have you ever had this happen? I have, where you're hitting something and it falls off. It doesn't just fall down, it kind of jumps out. And so they hit it and it jumps out into the river. The Jordan River is a muddy river. They can't find the axe head. So this would be like losing the car. Not the keys to the car, but the car. You lose the keys to the car, you go get another key. It's like losing the car. And so Elisha wasn't there. Elisha comes, and they go, "Father, we don't know what to do. We've lost the axe head." And, you know, it's like he could have said, "You jerks. You know, why didn't you check it out?" No, he goes, "Let me do some things," and he puts some things in the water, and the axe head floats. He could do miracles. It floats, and then they see it, and they go and get it, and fix it, and then give it back to the guy. This we learn. I just want to give you a quick lesson, if I could give you the first one here. God's mercy is seen in small things. I want you to write that down. We're going to go look at the next two verse by verse. But God's mercy is seen in small things. When you read 2 Kings chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then the balance of chapter 6, these are all very huge things. I mean, countries and people getting raised from the dead and people who can't eat having food for the rest of their lives and all these enormous things. And then you read this thing and go, an axe head? Really, who cares? And then you realize that the mercy of God is interested even in the small things. And the point of that is because everything is small to God. We think it's big for God to give Gene and Yannick a baby after 7 years of infertility and after the death of their first child, etc. And we think that's a big deal, but for God, that's not a big deal. We think it's a big deal when something happens. It's not, because everything's a small deal. But this is really a small deal for us, just fixing an axe head, and yet we see God's mercy in the small things. Now, go to verse 8, because now we're getting into some big things, some typical Old Testament stuff. Wars. Now, this war that was going on was a constant war. Back then, they fought usually in the spring and summer times, so they literally didn't fight year-round because they all had to go back and till the ground and get it ready for harvest, and then they'd all come back to war. We see this all through the Old Testament. Verse 8, once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel. And when we use the word Syria, by the way, let me just go to a side. It's the exact location where Syria is today. So if you're looking at a map on CNN and you see Damascus and Syria and you see Israel, it's the exact locations. Even the names many times are the exact same ones. So you don't have to be a geographer of 1,000 years before Christ and a geographer of 2,000 years after Christ. It's all the same places. Everywhere else in the world has changed. But that Middle East area is the same. It's really amazing. So the king of Syria was warring against Israel. He took counsel with his servants. In other words, they had their war council together. And he said, at such and such a time and place, I'm going to make camp. In other words, he was going to surreptitiously go to a certain place without the Israelites knowing it. And when the Israelites came, they were going to ambush them. There's a lot of mountains, a lot of valleys, a lot of wadis, all these things where they could hide behind things, and then when they're coming through a valley, they're up on the hill, they could just annihilate them. And so they had a specific place they were going to go to meet the Israelites without them knowing it. That's the picture. But the man of God, that's Elisha, but the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there. So how did Elisha know that this was going to happen? Well, because God exposed it to him. He's a prophet. He's getting miracles done. This is a time of incredible miracles of the Old Testament. So God is saying, tell the people, don't go down through that pass. And so then he tells the king and his king's people, don't go through to that pass. beware that you don't. And the king of Israel, verse 10, sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him so that he saved the king himself there more than once or twice. So this was going on. So the king of Syria would go to a certain place because he heard the Israelites were coming. No shows. So he would go to another place. He heard they were coming because he had spies in the camp of Israel. No show. And it kept going on and on. And finally, the king of Syria goes, there's a spy among us. There's got to be a spy who's going, hearing it, then by night going out and telling them, the Israelites. Verse 11, and the mind of the king was greatly troubled because of this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel? In other words, who is the spy? And one of his servants said, no one, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. That's a little scary. It's what he says in private with his counselors. And he said, he being the king of Syria, and he said, go and see where he is that I may send and seize him. That's Elisha. He's forgetting the Israelites now. He wants to go after Elisha. Now, Elisha is a poor man who's a man of God, and at this point only has one servant working with him. The other mentor or trainees are somewhere else. Elisha is at Dothan. Behold, he is in Dothan. It was told him, verse 14, so he sent their horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. Now, here's a man, Elisha, who probably has nothing but a little dagger in which to cut off the figs from the tree. He has no army, no men, no militia like David had or Saul or these other men had, the various kings, nothing. He has a servant who's not a military man, and himself, and the king set an entire division to surround Little Dothan. Now, Little Dothan was a very small village. Could have been a couple of huts. We don't know how big it is. And they surround the entire place. It's an incredible picture of overkill. Could have just gone with three people. If you wanted to kill him, it could have just taken three people, gone in the middle of the night. Verse 15, and this is key. I want you to get this. When the servant of the man of God, this is the unnamed servant. He used to have a servant named Gehazi, but this is a new servant. The servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, and behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the village or the city. Those cities aren't like Boca Raton and New York, little villages. And the servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? The picture is this. There's a small village, there's a few huts. He's coming out in the morning, probably just to wash his face or whatever they do in the morning as they come out, and there they all are, and he looks around. Hundreds of chariots, horses, army, archers, swordsmen, and there they are. And he is scared to death because he knows they're coming after him and his boss. Verse 16. He said, that's Elisha said, a lot of pronouns here. Elisha said, do not be afraid. And let me just pause there. Take out your pen and underline the next few words. And if you're on your iPad, highlight it. And here it is. For those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Can I repeat that? Those who are with us are more than those that are with them. Now, who was with us? It was Elisha, the servant, and there was no one else. And he said, there are more with us than with them. And then, this is such a beautiful thing, then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, please open my servant's eyes that he may see. And underline these words. So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Have you ever heard it said, one plus God equals a majority? That's a silly thing to say, but it's absolutely true. One plus God is a majority because God has his angels around us. Later this year, we're going to talk about angels, and we Americans don't like talking about angels except in this really silly way. But God has an army that is working on your behalf. And you do not know how many are in that army. And so when you look at what the issue is, you don't know how many God is working against that issue for you. And that may be personal health, as this was, personal safety. It could be financial, relational, whatever it is. God is working on your behalf, and God's resources are greater than everybody else's resources. This is a part of the belief you have to have. Can I give you two more verses here? Let's go to Psalms. You just write these down. Psalm 20, verse 7. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Some trust in chariots, some trust in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. If he had all of his resources brought together, it might have been 30 or 40 men. All the resources Elisha had could not have fought person to person against the king of Syria's men. It's impossible. You and I go and try to fight our battles, don't we? Can I just say, it's impossible. The enemy is stronger than you are. The enemy is not stronger than the person who is in you. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. But any of you who think you're strong enough against the enemy, I think is in for a rude awakening. You plus the power of God is that majority. Another verse, this is a great verse that we rarely look at, Psalm 68, verse 17. The chariots of God are twice 10,000, thousands upon thousands. The Lord is among them. Now, what does this mean? Does God have chariots? No, it's a picture. Now, you ever heard the song Amazing Grace? We all have, right? What's that last verse, or the last verse we normally sing? When we've been there 10,000 years. What is so big about 10,000? 10,000 was the largest normal denomination that people could think about in the ancient world. The word million and billion didn't exist back then. Yes, they could say 100,000, but what's interesting is nowadays we throw these words around, don't we? Our debt is 16 trillion. Do you know what 16 trillion is? No, you don't. Do you know what 16 billion is? No, you don't. Do you know what 16 million is? No, you don't. Has anyone been in a room with a million people? Maybe two or three of you, if you've been on the Mall of Washington or been in an Asian Billy Graham crusade many years ago, but that's only a few of us. I've never seen a million people at one place, and I get around. We don't even know how many times have you seen 10,000, well, maybe at a basketball game, football game, whatever, a few times you see a few thousand. For them, 10,000 was like saying to us a gazillion things. That is their number to say that it's beyond anything. We think it means 10,000, so 10,000 against 10,000. No, what they're saying here is it's thousands upon thousands. If this were written today, it would say a gazillion among gazillion, whatever the new word is. I mean, it just keeps changing, doesn't it? Used to be million back in the 1800s, then billion in the early 1900s, then trillion in the late 1900s, and now it's whatever the new more zeros, we just kind of add zeros on the end. But that's what it would be because God's resources are unlimited. You put the word in there you want that shows you that God is unlimited in his resources. Because God's mercy, go back to number two if you would. God has mercy in the big things. God shows mercy in the little things. God shows mercy in the big things. And the big things were this. He saved the people, the Israelites, from the king of Syria. And the second part of, he saved Elisha from the king of Syria. So whether it's saving a lot of people or saving just one person, God's resources come to bear. This is important because some people say to me, I don't want to bother God with this prayer. God is so busy in Africa. God is so busy in Syria. God is so busy doing all this work. Why would he care about me? Why would he care about me? Because God has a gazillion amounts of resources. And there's enough for you. So pray and ask him to be merciful upon you. And he will. Now, it doesn't mean he's going to give you more money or give you exactly what you want, but he's going to give you what you need. And all that the servant needed was to see that God even had the resources. Now, what happens here is beautiful. So another part of the miracle goes on, verse 18. And when the Syrians came down against him, so okay, they're coming. They just didn't stay up there. They wanted to wait till daylight. They came down. Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, please, it's a great way to start your prayer, by the way. I hear so many prayers demanding of God, do this, do that. Please, God, I mean, he's asking in penance, strike this people with blindness. It's a great thing. So there's who knows how many hundreds of chariots and all this stuff. He's there maybe with a dagger. And he says, we can't do this, Lord. You do it. Just strike them with blindness. In accordance with the prayer of Elisha. So he struck them with blindness. Verse 19. And Elisha said to them, they came down. Now they're all blind. He goes, come on, you're in the wrong city. Okay, is that deceit? You work out the ethics on that, but that's, I'm not going to argue the ethics here. You're going, oh, he deceived them. Okay, well, let's keep going. And he led them, come with me, I'll show you where you want to be. And at the end of that verse 19, and he led them to Samaria. Where was Samaria? That's where the king of Israel was. So he's leading all these chariots, come with me, I'll take you where you want to go. Technically, he was telling the truth because they really did want to kill the Israelites. So he is telling the truth. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elijah said, O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. So they get to Samaria. The Israelites surround them. You can see the picture. They surround the blind guys, and they're all there. They're off their horses and their chariots because they can't ride them. They're walking, being led by this man, and there they are. And, of course, they're taken captive. Hundreds of people taken captive in seconds, that fast. God can change anything at any speed he wants to. No blood, no battle. It was changed like that. As soon as the king, verse 21, of Israel saw this, he said to Elijah, my father, again he spoke with respect, shall I strike them all down? Let me kill them all. They're about to kill you. They want to kill us. And he says again, shall I strike them down? And Elisha, verse 22, answered, you shall not strike them down. Would you strike down a captive? No, you'd keep them POW. Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. So he prepared for them a great feast. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. That's not the ending I would have thought. I would have liked him just to annihilate the whole group. Right? These people have been harassing us. Now they're harassing me. Let's just let them all die. But Elisha shows mercy here. See, Elisha has seen mercy. He received mercy from God. And now he's saying, I need mercy. So number three is this. We are to show God's mercy. God was merciful in the small things. God was merciful in the big things, both to the Israelites and to Elisha. Now, Elisha has the first time to do something since those two merciful acts, and he says, I'm going to be merciful. And not just merciful, but he pours heaping coals, the scripture says, because when you give someone a cup of cold water, it's like pouring heaping coals on them. So he gives them food and prepares, prepares for these guys food and water and bread, and then sends them on their way. And so he does good to those who wanted to do bad to them. It's an interesting dynamic there of mercy. And my encouragement to us, and again, we're gonna spend more time on this summer, is how do we become merciful today when this is a country that is losing its concept of mercy? I'm right, you're wrong, you're right, you're wrong. We're all arguing, and mercy has kind of taken a back seat. But we as Christians are required to have mercy in the front seat with us. And how does that work? And that is something that you and I need to grapple with, and I cannot answer it in 5 minutes at the end. It's something you need to grapple with. How can you be merciful when, if I can use this word in its correct term, all hell is breaking out in this country? And I use that in its correct term, not its cursed term. All hell is breaking out throughout this country. Not in every place, at every moment, but you're just seeing the walls come down. How do we respond? And we're going to be looking at that, God willing, over after we finish through Uncommon over the next few weeks after June and into July as well. So, number one, God is merciful in the small things. God is merciful in the big things. What does that mean? God is merciful all the time. God has mercy. And God has called us to mercy. You and I are called to have and be merciful. Have mercy and to be merciful. Now, let me give you a simple example of this that I saw mercy committed to me and Elizabeth one time, many times actually, but by a person so we could see this. Let me share this story with you. 23 years ago, March 23 years ago, we had to take our son to a specialist, to a hospital specialist. And our doctors said, we had a young son, a little younger than yours, and she said, the doctor, there's only one doctor in the country that can handle this problem, and he's in Boston. And I said, we know nobody in Boston. Can't we go to Children's Hospital in Dallas, in Chicago, in Miami, in Tampa, at Gainesville? We know people there who could help us, families and other Christians. We have no connection in Boston. And they said, no, Boston is the only place where this doctor is, and you need this team for this problem, and he can work through this problem. So on a plane, this child and I went, and Elizabeth joined us in a few days. And as we were sitting, they were there for 3 weeks, two operations. Every day, people came to us, and we're in the waiting room most of the time because we could only see him just a few hours a day. He was in an incubator. And so we're in the waiting room all the 18 hours a day, and every day people would come, and the receptionist became our friend because it's like a little community in these waiting rooms. And so the receptionist would say every day, Bill, or Mr. Mitchell, I forget what she called us, a friend of yours is at the front door of the wing. And I always answered her this way, I have no friends in Boston. I have no friends in Boston. And someone would come who was a friend of one of you, who you called, and they came to visit us every day. Next day, someone would come, Pastor Bill, I wasn't a pastor then, Bill, friends are here to see you. And I would laugh and I'd go, I have no friends in Boston. And friends would come, people I never knew. It got so many people that I'd say, who told you? And they would name them and I wouldn't know the name because you would have called someone who called someone else who called someone else and they came and visited us. So 2 weeks into this, we were there 3 weeks, 2 weeks into it, it was the week before Easter, towards April, late March, early April, and a guy comes. Elizabeth was in with our son, and a guy comes. I didn't want to see anybody. It wasn't the time to see, and the lady calls into the room, says, a friend of yours is here. I didn't laugh. I didn't say anything. I said, send him in. He comes in, and it was the younger brother of a member of our church, and he was a construction worker, obviously. He had gotten off. He came in, and he didn't talk. He just sat there. He sat there. What do? You sat there. And I wasn't in the mood to talk, so I sat there. And we just sat next to each other. And I finally just said, what do you do? He goes, I'm a construction worker. I have my own job, you know, a little home improvement. I'm a one-man shop. I live in a suburb. He said, I shut down my business. I came in for the day to see you because my brother kept calling me every day and said, have you visited the Mitchells? And so he did it out of obligation. And he sat there. And at the end of this very strained 30 minutes, he said these words to me. And I knew it was just kind of, I'm sure out of the words of his brother, he said, is there anything I can do for you? He didn't say it that happy. It was kind of like, is there anything I can do for you? You know, have you ever done that? He didn't want me to answer it. But I did. It was a time in our lives when we had had a financial reversal. We didn't have a lot of money. In fact, we had no money. We were young. We had nothing. And it was Easter coming up, and I said, I'd like to give all the nurses and technicians and all the people that are helping our son a Bible for Easter. I said, would you buy us a box of Bibles? And he looked at me exasperated and said, yes. Now, that's before Amazon and all these things. And so he goes out, gets a box of Bibles, and has them back to me the next morning. And he brings him back in. I didn't think anything of it. I thanked him. We sent him a note of thank you, and we're passing out Bibles on Good Friday and had a great time. Then we left and came back to Florida, so we were able to come back. He was healthy enough. Months later, my friend here said, because I had thanked him for his son, his brother, younger brother, he said, I got to tell you the story about my brother. He said, when he came to visit you, that was the first act of mercy he can remember ever doing. And I said, what do you mean? He said he had to close his business down. He had to park his car in an expensive parking. He had to do all these things. Then he had to spend $100-something to buy all these Bibles for you and all this stuff. And he said, he's a new Christian and he's never done any of this. And I said, well, thank you. He said, but I got to tell you the rest of the story. It's changed his life. It's transformed his life. He said, because he acted in mercy when he didn't want to, God showed him such grace that we just sang about and such joy that he does it every week now. He takes a day off his business and goes and visits people who are at various needs of his life, and now he's helping them with small construction jobs and helping single mothers. And he said he has a whole ministry once a week because he did an act of mercy. You see, acts of mercy benefit many people, and one of them they benefit is you, the giver of the mercy. And my challenge to you today is to be a person of mercy. To be a person of grace. Yes, you will help the other person. We were incredibly helped by all the gracious and merciful acts of dozens of people. We were given a house to stay in that was walking distance. We were given food. We were given jackets because it was still March up there. We had nothing. Hats, gloves, everything was given to us. We had nothing. And through the merciful acts of other believers, and now this new believer, our life was changed, and his life, and maybe many others, were changed as well. You see, when you do mercy, there are more than one person that has benefited from it. Not that you do mercy to get mercy. You do mercy because God is a God of mercy, and we're supposed to do what God tells us to do. But there's an incredible reward that comes when you are a person of mercy. Have you ever done it? Am I saying the truth or not? It is the truth. Be a person of mercy. Let's pray together.